This morning I am, well, morning my time, afternoon Rachel's time. Rachel's in London. I'm interviewing Rachel Kelly. And full disclosure, we did a wonderful interview before and it wasn't recorded. So we have this great opportunity to talk again. And you've written, well, many articles, but three books. And two of your books are about your journey with depression. And your latest book is on healing foods for depression. And I want to shift gears a little bit from our last interview, which was amazing. There was so much. I wish it had been recorded because there was so much, a wealth of information that you shared on nutrition and depression. And I'd love to know more about that today, but also delve into the two previous books, the memoirs that you wrote on depression, not just depression, but you know, there was a journey in there. And the title of this interview series is Write Your Story, Heal Your Life.
Right.
So I would, and I know the viewers would love to know about how healing or how important it was for you to share your story.
You know, the finding is, I don't know if you can see, but assuming our filming is working this time, I've actually gone rather goosebumpy. And Andrew Motion, who is the poet laureate, said that when something strikes you right to the heart, you know, it's almost like you do have a physical reaction. And there's something just hearing you say the title of your talk. I mean, to me, that's incredible synchronicity because, you know, writing your story and using it to heal your story, you know, has been completely at the heart of my own dread word, but journey. So I've actually done four books. I mean, the first was a poetry anthology, which I edited, which was for children. It was called If Poems, Poems for Every Possibility. And I think having been quite unwell with anxiety and depression, I needed something quite gentle to kind of seg back into working. And in a way, that did give me some confidence. And my first sort of memoir was called Black Rainbow, How Words Can Heal Me, My Journey Through Depression. And that came out in 2014. It actually took me around 6 or 7 years to write. It was both a very painful process, also a therapeutic process, because it was around, it was a story of around of a sort of really a kind of 15 year journey from my first major depressive episode. So that was in 1997. Then I had a second major one in 2004, when I was really pretty ill, for around 2 years. And, I know how ill I was because I didn't do a school run during that period. And anybody who's listening, who's a mom or a parent, will know how much that means to people. So that I kind of got through the worst of the serious depression in around 2006. So the last 10 years or so has been a kind of journey to really discover the evidence-based strategies about what to do to stay calm and well. And that's led to two more books, Walking on Sunshine, 52 Small Steps to Happiness, and The Happy Kitchen, Good Mood Food. But just to rewind to Black Rainbow, which was the story, you know, how writing it was therapeutic. I suppose the main way it was very therapeutic for me was that felt like a very wasted period. That felt like wasted years of being unwell on and off over that 12-year period. And I hate waste. I'm a great recycler. I think having been a journalist, I knew about the spike. You know, we used to have an electronic cue called the spike. So if your article didn't get used, it hit the spike. And I was always trying to think of ways to reuse articles. And I hated the idea that, in a way, all this experience that I had, it was not going to be of any use to anybody else, and it wasn't recorded. So that was the very positive therapeutic thing, was making something out of nothing, in a way, any kind of creative endeavor. And I suppose that was the first thing. And I suppose the second thing was feeling I did have something to say and I had something to share. And in that way, it was also kind of healing.
Thank you for sharing that. This morning, I interviewed an author And she also has a website that is about focused on parenting when the parents may have had trauma in their life. And, you know, basically how to break those patterns. And she's, we were talking about writing memoir when you're sharing those raw stories, but the truthful stories and the things that can be difficult to write about. And also with writing that, you know, how people are going to react. And also talking, when to reacting, meaning people that we may be writing about in our memoirs, but the importance of sharing our stories and how we spoke about in the last interview, the importance of talking about depression.
Yeah. I think that really resonates because there is still a big stigma about talking about depression, and it's beginning to shift, and there's been a lot happening in the UK with the royals and things talking about it. But I think in my sort of neighborhood of people who don't obviously have anything to be depressed about, maybe you have a job or, you know, you're a journalist or a doctor or got a small business or an accountant, and there isn't anything obviously to be depressed about. You know, I have a very lucky and privileged life, and I wanted to make the point that a privileged life doesn't necessarily mean a privileged health. And I think with stigma, though, some of the sort of celebrities have done great work. There's a slight feeling that sometimes that, you know, maybe their lives are a bit crazy and up and down, or, you know, maybe their lives don't resonate with this kind of more kind of middle group, and people don't necessarily identify. They think that their lives are different. And, you know, if you're suffering real social deprivation, there's an understanding that maybe you might suffer from depression and there's less stigma. So I think you're right. There was something important to say about addressing that stigma, and that's very particular to kind of mental illness and memoirs around them. I'm interested in your comment around your, you know, a lady writing about parenting, and I think there's something, you know, memoir is different to autobiography. You know, we're not just saying you're born at a day, you die at a day. I think that there's always an endeavor to understand something. You know, you set out in a way with some mysteries of your own, and I think there's that process of self-discovery about, you know, maybe she found that too. You know, what did she learn? And I think you can learn about yourself and about what really happened in the process of trying to make sense of it on the printed page. So set, you know, alongside sort of diffusing stigma, not making something creative and positive out of a dark time, but also answering some questions. You know, well, why did this really happen? Right. You know, why did it happen when it happened? And what was really going on? And I'm not saying I've answered all those questions. I think there's always a kind of more questions, but I think that's what memoir can do in a very therapeutic way, is help answer some of these questions.
Yes.
But by really finding the truth, you know.
Yes, and finding your own truth, because I'm a writer and I'm a writing coach. I facilitate a women's writing group. But really talking about that, I believe that we write for ourselves. It really has to be that we write for ourselves first.
And yeah.
You know, of course, if we're writing a novel, we are thinking of our readers, and there's a certain place in a memoir. If we really want it published, we're also thinking of who the readers are, who's the narrator, who's the reader.
Yeah.
But as a memoir with a particular story, and oftentimes there's challenges in a story that you read in memoir, that we are writing, even if we don't know it consciously, unconsciously, that we're writing to heal. So we're writing for ourselves. So it's one reason I was attracted to your work, because of, you know, as you were saying, that there's four books, but three are really looking at the story. And I had shared with you after our interview that someone that I was very fond of recently took her life.
Yeah.
And not just me, but everyone who knew her was really like, this was the last person on the planet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so on the outside, it was very, you know, she was a very confident person, you know, a very loving and supportive family, and a good career as a therapist. And now things had changed in her life, the family structure. But again, it's we can't see that outside. We can't often see on the outside the internal suffering.
I think you make a really good point, and I think that notion of the kind of exterior life and the interior life, and sometimes I heard a kind of definition of good mental health is when the two are lined up, and when they're kind of not as one, and the image that we project. So people sometimes talk about smiling depressives. So they're confusing for the outside world because, you know, like your friend, you know, everybody thinks they're sort of more or less sorted. Though probably there's a clue in the fact that she chose to be a therapist. And, you know, sometimes I feel a bit of an imposter because, like, it's like, you know, have I worked everything out? Well, no. I mean, I'm very, you know, I feel I'm constantly learning and I'm trying to share sort of good evidence-based strategies about strategies for good mental health. But, you know, I wouldn't write about this stuff if I found it easy. You know, you write about what you need to learn. And so I think sometimes, you know, the very clue there perhaps was that, you know, if she'd chosen to be a therapist, there was some wounding there that she was trying to address in her work. So I think that it's almost a kind of irony that, you know, people who write memoir, particularly with a therapeutic purpose for themselves and for others, is that there's often a kind of big wound there. And that's why you do it. Otherwise, you know, if you didn't find it difficult, you wouldn't do it. But I think that's something I think that's particularly pertinent with mental health, which is that, you know, we can keep up a kind of carapace, a facade, and that actually, you know, if we can be in touch with our real feelings and this kind of union of body and mind, and that sometimes our body tells us something and, you know, our mind is in denial. So maybe our mind is saying, yes, you've got a great job and you've got a house and you've got a husband and you've got the kids. You supposedly ticked all the boxes, but sometimes we sicken and it may be that there's something that doesn't really fit. I mean, in my case, I had the kind of supposedly prestigious job, which is what I wanted. I worked as a journalist on the Times newspaper. But, you know, it was a really stressful job. And I was reading recently and chatting recently about the idea that, you know, maybe a serious depressive episode, you know, an evolution, it was meant to teach us something. You know, maybe we can have these periods of great anxiety or even depression, but, you know, there may be something we really need to address in our life. What we're not supposed to have is kind of chronic, i.e. ongoing depression over a long period. And I think that was the truth for me, that there were some things I had to look at in my life, and I have a very different life now, and actually a very super stressful life in a newsroom of a newspaper. You know, it wasn't a very good fit with my very anxious, driven nature. I mean, I sometimes think we're drawn to jobs to which we're not suited.
Yes. And also, I've been having conversations with different people and in interviews. You know, sometimes we need that challenge or that difficult situation in our life to really go through that dark period for us to really acknowledge that, no, I'm not suited to this. You know,
I think there's something positive that can come, which is that, and there's a lovely line in Corinthians in the Bible, says, my strength is made perfect in wisdom. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, what can seem like a very negative, destructive, dark period, you know, you may emerge stronger. You know, I think there's something in that. That's a nice, possibly positive take on, you know, why we have to go sometimes through these very dark periods.
It also, yes, and thank you for sharing that quote. And it also makes me think about Persephone, you know,
go down to the underworld.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how often in our lives, or how many people really do go into the underworld? And hopefully, when we come up, it's that we have been through this struggle, this darkness, and then can we come up the other side and reflect on it? And rather than have shame around it, or just, you know, not talk about that, but be open and honest, because in our honesty, in our being authentic, it actually is helping others to connect.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, there's plenty of work that telling our story and talking about it, writing about it. So it's seen as a preventative measure by doctors. It helps, as you say, to reduce stigma. It reduces isolation. It makes us feel more connected with others, which is good for our mental health. There's also something very interesting about when we can find images and metaphors and ways of describing something, it reduces the intensity. So they do it in conflict resolution and sort of hostage negotiation, that if, for example, someone is in a terrible fury and anger, before you can negotiate, you need to be able to bring that emotion down, and just describing it and writing us feel calmer. So when we're faced with very difficult emotions, so there's one idea that depression is anger turned in. It could be one's angry in a kind of way that one doesn't acknowledge, but by going into that anger and maybe describing it, or grief or sadness or whatever, some of these very difficult things, actually describing them, putting words around them, helps us moderate and be able to cope with those emotions. So I think that's something really positive about writing your story, that that was certainly true for me. And I think certainly acknowledging anger was a huge one for me, because I'd always been the good girl and, very dutiful and the good mom and the good wife, the good worker. And, I was angry, but I didn't acknowledge it. You know, I asked too much myself. Sometimes too many people ask too much of me, partly because I was misleading and always said yes. So I had some stuff to learn around saying no. And you know, I think one thing I learned is just that, you know, the reason we have to learn to say no is that then only then can we really have a positive yes. Whereas I had a lot of yeses which were actually no's. Right. And then I was angry because I said yes when I really meant no. And then, you know, this idea that anger can, you know, build up and it is very toxic to us. So I think that was a really useful thing for me, was to actually use words and go into kind of describing and acknowledging some of these tricky emotions, and in acknowledging them, they became less frightening, and it was the starting point of beginning to able to heal, really.
I think you have a couple of really important points there that you shared, and one that really stands out to me is the anger and the no's, being able to say no and yes. And for me, it's only been, a handful of years that I've really said no. It's really hard for me to say no to my children, and I think often as mothers, we're so in that nurturing role, and then suddenly we have to say no.
I quite agree. I think one image that helps me, I don't know if it helps you, is, you know, on an airplane, you put your oxygen mask on first before you fix your child's. And I think that's something to hang on to, that unless we can nurture and look after ourselves, you know, we're no good to anybody as mothers, as, you know, as writers, as wives, as whatever our role in life. So I think that's a hard lesson for women particularly, because we're kind of brought up to put others first.
We are, absolutely. And I love that image, Rachel. I'm going to keep that image of, and share that about put your oxygen mask on first.
Yeah.
And when you're when they say that, it almost seems, you know, like this is reversed, you know, like, don't you put that on your child first? Of course.
Yeah.
How are you going to take care of them?
And yeah.
Yeah. It's been such a journey for me to say no. And I know that it's imperative now in my self-care to say no. And my children,
and my
children are now 32 and 35. I have two daughters. And
wow, child bride, that's amazing. You look so young. What are you? You need to write a cookbook. Whatever you're eating, whatever you're doing.
Yeah, well, I can share with you 100% truthfully, I'm not doing any plastic surgery or any Botox or anything like that. You know, I've never been a drinker, never smoked, and I'll have an odd cocktail. And I just pretty much, because I've had a health issue all my life, I've had very severe asthma. I've also seen it as my gift to eat really well. And
Yeah.
Which actually is a really good segue to talk about your book, because it's not available out in the US. I think it comes out in August. Is that right here?
It comes out end of September with Simon Schuster, which is very exciting.
It's so exciting. I actually have told people about it already, because people I've mentioned it to have really shown interest in ordering it. And I've said that we can order it from Amazon.
Yes.
Yes. Because I
have... You could probably start to be able to pre-order. Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of chronology is that, you know, I had these two major depressive episodes, and far from learning anything from the first one, I just shut the topic down, didn't change anything. But I think after the second one, when I was so ill for so long, I just thought, right, okay, you know, maybe my body is trying to tell me something. And that was the journey to try and discover some of these other, you know, psychological and physical approaches to staying calm and well. And I think what I've learned is that, you know, just like diabetes happens if certain kinds of, we eat too much sugary foods, you know, our mental illness happens in a context, and we can improve that context and make it less likely. And so I suppose that's really when nutrition came along. I'd already adjusted my lifestyle. I quit being a sort of reporter in a newsroom. I started working alongside some mental health charities, volunteering in my local prison, very different kind of work life, and writing, but not to a deadline, not journalism, you know, very different kind of writing. And it was at that point, it was around 5 years ago, I went to see my GP, just a routine checkup, how are you getting on with the anxiety? And you know, we were looking at some of these ideas. And then almost as I was leaving, she said, what about happy foods? And I said, what do you mean happy foods? She said, well, you know, I'm not a nutritionist. So doctors in the UK get about 2 hours of nutritional training in a 7-year training.
Right.
But she said, there's some good evidence around particularly oily fish, omega-3s, dark green leafy vegetables, and dark chocolate, which has a lot of magnesium, which is very calming. And I was just electrified, because I'd kind of known around nutritional interventions for cancer and heart disease, but it just hadn't occurred to me that there was a big link with mental illness. So I kind of being quite a sort of nerdy type and always feeling this responsibility that, you know, only keen on evidence-based strategies, because especially working with vulnerable people with my charities, I'm an ambassador for SANE and I'm an ambassador for Rethink. I'm also an ambassador for Young Minds. So I'm working with very vulnerable people, and I didn't want to go out with anything that wasn't really evidence-based. So I teamed up with a lovely lady called Alice McIntosh, nutritional therapist. I went to see her. I said, you know, I still have some of these symptoms. I've got patches of insomnia, low mood, anxiety, hormones around all over the place, which is often linked to anxiety. So, you know, menopausal women or postnatal women, teenagers, menopausal men, in fact. And so we worked together for 5 years going through the symptoms. You know, what was the evidence? And in the end, we've come up with 70 recipes, and they're based on 150 nutritional studies. And, it, you know, it's really exciting, because I think it's going to be very big in a lot of these lifestyle illnesses that, you know, we're not doing very well in the West. We're not doing well in the US. Obesity, diabetes. Sorry, I think I might have lost you.
Yes, you're
still there.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so in general, we're not doing very well with lifestyle illnesses in the US and the UK. So diabetes, obesity, mental illness, some of these chronic ongoing illnesses. And I think what we'll find in the next 10, 15 years in medicine, that some of these lifestyle interventions are really going to come to the fore. They're going to take the place of medication, and nutrition will be absolutely key. I was interested recently, I was in Israel. In Israel, if you see a psychiatrist, you see a nutritionist at the same time.
Amazing.
So I think this will be the future. I think it's a very much more holistic approach to our well-being, and it will encompass, you know, our spiritual well-being, our psychological well-being, you know, how we talk to ourselves, do we consider ourselves lovable, do we look after ourselves, all these ideas of self-care. And I think nutrition is a wonderful one, because, you know, you have a chance to make those decisions 5-6 times a day. And so it's just a really lovely one to work with people. So it's been a really positive, from you know, sharing a very dark and debilitating story to actually sharing some really practical ideas. And I think where I am at the moment is I think that everybody's mental health is nuanced and complicated. We know we all have a complicated story. But I think something really lovely is that some of the ideas for good mental health are really straightforward. They're quite simple and they really work. So that's something very positive. And, you know, 70% of people do recover from depression. And I think sometimes it can feel too sort of negative and you know, we're not going to get over these things. I'm a real optimist.
That I'm really glad that you shared that. I was with a friend last week and we actually played tennis, which means I hit the ball about 5 times. And so, but she's a therapist and we were talking, well, we played at the tennis courts at the local high school. And there was a couple of things that came up in conversation. One, they had just filmed a TV series there. And the TV series, I haven't watched it, is the story is about a teenage girl who actually commits suicide.
Mm-hmm.
But just after the filming at another school in the last couple of weeks, a teenage girl did commit suicide.
Oh, goodness. Right.
And what my friend was saying, who is a psychotherapist, she said, depression is so treatable.
Right. That's so interesting. That's so interesting. So I think it's the case, certainly in the UK, and I think in the US, is in the last 10 years, we have a new at-risk group that we didn't used to have, which is teenage girls. There's a very particular issue around teenage girls right now. We know always that young men are vulnerable to suicide, and that's been the case for a while. But there's this new group who are very vulnerable, and there is something going on. The internet is not helping. Social media is not helping. There's something about how we've lost a kind of embodied experience. Everything is kind of experienced online. So classic, you know, you might get 2 teenage girls in a restaurant, and instead of actually stopping and nourishing themselves and enjoying the food, or, you know, taking a photo and sharing it on Snapchat or whatever. So there's always this sense that we're not in our bodies. And I think one of the ways I now understand mental health is it's not just body and mind are linked. They are actually indissoluble. So I think there is something around body image, the way the internet's playing out, that we're losing this kind of, you know, integrity between body and mind, integrity between the inner and the outer. And for all sorts of reasons, teenage girls are really vulnerable on those axes. So, you know, it's dreadful, really, because as you say, depression is treatable. And I'm really hoping that, you know, some of these evidence-based strategies is beginning to happen in, you know, in terms of education and giving people some of these tools in terms of, you know, what they can do to help themselves. So I'm hoping that this may be the worst point and that we will learn, because obviously that is such a complete tragedy.
It is a complete tragedy. And one thing I remember when we spoke last time, that you were saying working on this book and with the nutritionist,
Alice McIntosh, yeah, she's wonderful.
That you will often see results in one day.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that is, again, really optimistic, which is that I'm sure you know that the very best antidepressants, they can take 2 weeks to kick in.
Yeah.
Whereas I'd been working with one of the big psychiatric hospitals here in London, the Maudsley, and if you cut out what is a useful acronym, which is CRAP, so you lose the carbonated drinks, refined sugar, aspartame and additives, and processed meats and processed foods, you can see a change in a day in terms of mood. It's that quick. And I'm sure you're aware of all the work that's been done on the links between the brain and the gut. So basically there's a vagus nerve that runs between them. And our stomach sends messages to our head, and our head sends messages to our stomach. And you will know that the microbiome, the gut flora, that what we need is much more variety to stay calm and well. There's plenty of nice studies there. As I say, we looked at 150 studies. But basically, some of the interventions, so having more of the probiotics, the fermented foods, the yogurts, the sauerkrauts, the kefir, as well as the prebiotics, so that's the green leafy vegetables and the things that the good bacteria feed on, if you put in some of those changes, your microbiome can change within 4 or 5 days. So it's very, very positive that you can move fast on nutrition. You really can. So I think that's something, again, to hang on. I would never say no to medication, but even if you need the medication, and it can be absolutely life-saving for some people, you know, it's more effective with some of these other interventions. So it's a no-brainer, really.
It's and it literally is like the when you say that, I'm thinking of the no-brainer that we are connecting. I remember last time you were saying that 80% of your serotonin is made in the gut.
Yeah. So I think that's just it's more like 90% actually. So.
Incredible.
It's a little bit nuanced because we want the serotonin, and there are some foods you can eat to get it, like bananas, kiwis, another one, walnuts. And it does help certain things. It helps the digestive system, and it also helps the muscular system. But it's not quite so simple because, unfortunately, there's this thing called the blood-brain barrier. So we can't just get serotonin from what we eat. It's a little bit more complicated. I think otherwise we'd have had lots of serotonin diets by now, which right. we haven't had because – it is more complicated. There are other ways to boost serotonin, exercise, sunshine. But I think it does tell you much more how it's a much more complicated full body system than just something happening in your head. Right. I think nobody really now thinks that it's just about, you know, a few chemical levels here and there in your head. I think many more scientists and doctors now are seeing this whole body system. And one key to that, which I think, again, is going to be huge, and we're beginning to get the research, and we've got some about it in the book, is this kind of idea that some of these chronic, ongoing lifestyle illnesses, they may be to do with low levels of inflammation.
Right.
So in the stomach and in the head. And again, dietary interventions can really help. And one of the reasons that the omega-3s are really helpful is that anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
But it's all part of this idea that there's this kind of link between our brain and our body, and we have Descartes to blame, actually, in the 17th century. Yeah, he split mind and body, and basically that informs modern medicine.
Right.
And I think we'll look back on this as a very dark age, and you know, good psychiatrists and good doctors are really putting the two together now.
Thank you, and before I forget, just when you said it's a very dark age. I don't know the actual numbers, but in terms of the dark age, I recently saw, and I'm blanking on his name, and I actually had one of his artworks because I met him before he was famous.
Wow.
The English artist who does the pottery, you know, the amazing pottery.
Edmund de Wall.
No, he also wears dresses. He has these flamboyant.
Grayson Perry.
Grayson Perry. So Grayson, Grayson when I was like 18. But one of his, you know, he has his own TV series now.
Yeah.
And he went up to the north of England. And basically, you know, he was talking to the men, you know, and it was in Newcastle. I think it was in Newcastle. And basically, you know, talking about their lives, their jobs, but what he really investigating was the high amount of suicide.
Right. Yeah.
And I believe I didn't jot it down. I was actually watching it when I was on flying to England on Virgin. But it was something like it was the highest death rate, form of death for men in England between 30 and 45. It was something, you know, this is very, very high.
Yeah, death. That's right. It's the single biggest killer of death. It's certainly in men, and I up to 45. I think basically men don't really go to the doctor much. Women tend to go more up to 45 through families and their children, and then roughly kind of illnesses kind of catch up with both men and women from 50. But through that period, on the whole, young men are kind of free of many health complaints, but they do die, and unfortunately they die of suicide, or young, this violent crime, but suicide is right up there. It is a very particular issue with men finding it hard to open up and show their vulnerability. So it's classic formula is that women find it hard to be angry and men find it hard to be vulnerable.
And that's what Grayson was really touching on in this particular episode.
Yeah.
Of, you know, he was asking
yeah.
the family of these, you know, young one was a very young man, like, was there any signs? And they said, no, you know, he was coming.
Yeah.
He seemed to be the life and soul of the party. And going back,
yeah,
we're seeing the depressives with a smile. And I wanted to mention that to really bring the severity of the issue. And with your work, not only are you an author, you're a writer, and you are working with these charities and nonprofits like SANE and doing so much important work. And that's why I feel, and I know many of our viewers will feel, that this latest book of yours I don't know if you have a copy at hand that you could actually hold up so that we could see.
Yes, I'm sure I do. Hang on a sec. Yes, I do. Hang on. I've just, I just show you. Oh, well, thank you. Yes, so in fact, I can show you. So this was my memoir of debilitating depression, my Black Rainbow memoir. So that came out in paperback a couple of years ago. So that was the very dark story. I then shared, as you say, I run workshops for charities. I work at actually around the country. I'm trying to work a little bit more locally now because I was getting a little bit run ragged. But this came out of my work with my workshops. So they're 52 ideas, one for each week of the year. They're things I've been doing with my workshops. They're all kind of evidence-based. Some strategies for mind, some strategies for body. And actually this one came out recently in the US with Simon Schuster. And then this is the one, this came out here in the UK this year. This is my one about how, you know, eating for happiness and nutrition and mental health. And this has just come out, as I say. Again, evidence-based strategies, things that can help. And the way we did it, I don't know if you can see, but those are our chapters. So looking very specifically at the symptoms you might have if you're feeling a bit low, a bit depressed, anxious, or even if you're not, but you just want to really feel good. So it's not about eating to lose weight. It's just about how you feel when you eat. And the nice thing is you will get to a good natural weight if you follow these ideas. But the real idea is that this is about eating for happiness. So those are our ideas. And we have a really useful good mood food index, which just shows you the sort of things that are really going to boost you and the things which are going to not boost you so much. We never say good and bad. I can hold that up a little bit longer.
Yeah. But
we don't say good and bad because actually if you say something's bad, people are drawn to it. So our whole tone is sort of nourishing and nurturing. And you know, these are the things to aim for. And these things are not so healthy, but we try not to sort of demonize things. And it's always about a celebration and a kind of gentle voice, really. So yeah, it's an exciting, it's been a very, I would never have known when I was so ill that something wonderful could have come of it. And you know, it has. And connecting with people like you and you know, I found my tribe and I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but I wouldn't, it's made me who I am in a way.
Yes. And I know that you have to go, and that is just such a wonderful way to wrap that sort of not, it's sort of, you know, often we say, let's not, you know, don't want to regret the past. But I think, you know, when we expand on that, it's the past is really what makes us. And you've turned these challenging times in your life into something. I don't know, want to say the word positive, but it definitely is that you've been able to produce bodies of work that you can share that really are a gift, and especially a gift to people who may be suffering from depression or not before. And it's just a wonderful resource. And I really hope that people jump over to the website. I'm going to put a link to your website. So, you know, when we're watching things, we don't take notes. It's like, what was the title of that book? But I really recommend your work. And again, it's been so wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yes. I'd love to stay in contact. And let's have tea when I'm over in London. Probably not.
Absolutely. I will.
Sorry.
Well, I will cook you some good mood food, and we'll celebrate.
I would love that.
Yeah.
Love that.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
Really?
Yeah. So we'll stay in touch. I'm going goosebumpy again.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Look after yourself. Lots of love. Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.